Hi, I'm Alvina Ling.
And I'm Grace Lin.
And we're Book Friends Forever.
We're childhood friends that grew up to be
a children's book editor
and an author and illustrator.
Welcome to Book Friends Forever. This is the Chop Suey, Fishing, Publishing News, Caldecott Predictions, and Book Recommendations episode. As a reminder, once a month we'll have an odds and ends episode where we cover several topics which we're calling the Chop Suey. And every week we catch up with each other's lives, talk about what's on our minds, and share with each other what we're grateful for.
And check out our website, bookfriendsforever.com. The website will include more detailed show notes as well as links to the episodes.
And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And if you enjoy our podcast, please tell a friend about it. And also, please consider joining our Patreon. We would love your support to keep this podcast going.
Yes, we really would. We'd like to thank our very first two patrons, Sheila and Satya. I'm sorry if I said your name wrong. Thank you so much for becoming patrons. The rest of you listeners, you can join at patreon.com/bookfriendsforever1. You have to add the numeral one. The link is in the show notes as well as on our webpage.
Oh, well, and you should remember, you can get a beautiful notebook if you join.
Yes, only while supplies last. Anyway, Alvina, how have you been?
I have been pretty good. We're recording this on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, which is Monday, January 18th. So I had a nice 3-day weekend, although I did do, of course, some work. I had mentioned in a previous episode that my friend Erica had been staying with us, and we've been just helping her move. So actually just a couple hours ago, we helped her move the remainder of which she still has a few things here, mainly her plants, but she's moving into her own condo and there's all this work being done in the condo. So she didn't want the plants to get all dusty. I think I should also mention that I'm sure you've all heard my cat meowing in the background on occasion, back, you know, at home in the condo and, you know, recording out of my closet. So, you know, my cat sometimes is very vocal, but it is a cat. It's not a baby crying. Anyway, so yeah, I think, so I've been good. I feel like I've been in this like state of transition for a long time, mm-hmm. which is interesting, but it, you know, things are, I feel like I'm a little bit in limbo, but I'm excited. Yeah. I'm excited for new beginnings and new chapters. How about you? How have you been?
Well, I have a very dramatic story to share, a dramatic story with a good ending. I'll put that in the beginning now so people don't have to feel stressful when I tell the entire story. So it's starting to be tax season for me. So I was starting to do get my tax stuff in order. And there was a couple of transactions that I wanted clarification from my bank. So the way that my bank works is that you have to kind of send them a message and then they'll call you back. So I did that. I sent them a message, they called back, and there's all these kind of security protocols that they do to make sure that they're talking to the right person. You know, there's verification code and security questions. So I talked to them and I got the information I needed and everything was fine. Then the next day, the day after I had had the normal exchange with my bank, I got another phone call that was said on my phone from my bank, the same exact number as the day before. And I talked to someone and the person said, "Oh, Grace Lin, we're calling because we just found a fraud transaction on your account. We just want to verify some of these things." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And he's like, "First, I need to do the verification things as usual." And I was like, "Okay." And so the same thing, you know, like verification codes and the security questions, like they were different security questions than before, but I thought that was fine, you know? And then we went through the whole rigmarole. Basically, he's like, did you buy something at Target for $80 in Colorado? And I was like, "No, I didn't." And went through all these things to get, okay, then we're going to have to change your cards. We're going to have to cancel your account. I need to verify your username and all these things. So, you know, is your username this? And I was like, "Oh, no, my username is this." And I told him my username. And he's like, "Okay." And then he's like, "Okay. And the last four digits of your social security number is this, correct? And I was like, no, it's this. And, so I told him all that. And then he's like, okay, well, I put a new temporary password for you. And your new temporary password is, I'm just going to make it up because it's, because I don't want to, just in case, but it was basically, he's like, I'm going to create a new temporary password for you. And it's green 123. And then that's when I'm like, wait a minute, that's a really, really dumb password.
Right.
And I was like, green 123. And I was like, I felt like, wait, maybe this isn't quite right. And then he's like, okay, and this is your case number. And then he hung up, or we got cut off. And I was like, okay, there's no case number. Like, I need to know. So I went to the computer and I tried to log on as like green 123, and I couldn't get on. And I was like, okay, this is really weird. And at that point, he had called at about 5 o'clock. And at that point it was like 5:20 or 5:30. And so I called the bank. Nobody was at the bank. So the only thing they had was a 24-hour ATM, you know, if you have fraud on your ATM, to call there. So I called the ATM woman and I said, you know, somebody called me about fraud on my case, fraud on my account. And I need to know, I want to know the case number. And she's like, okay. And she did all the same verification things. Like, I'm going to send you a verification number. Let me ask you the questions. And then she opened up my account and she's like, there's no fraud case on your account. She's like, and there's never been one. She's like, there's no fraud at all. I don't have any record of it. And I was like, oh.
And you're like, but now I have fraud.
And I told her, like, now I have fraud. I need to close this down. And she's like, oh, well, I can freeze your ATM card, you know, and your credit card, but I cannot freeze your online banking because that's not in my jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And I said, but I can't get into my online account now. It's like, it says that my password and username has been changed, like all these things. And she's like, I can't help you. I'm sorry. And while she was telling me this, I get an alert on my email. It says, you have added as a new bill pay for new bill pay. And I was like, if this is not supposed to happen, please contact us. And I'm like, so I started freaking out. And I was like, you know, the fraud is happening right now. I just got the automatic alert. And like, I need to close this account down now. And she's like, I'm sorry, you just have to wait until tomorrow. She's like, I'll call right now. And hold on. And she called. She's like, no, nobody's there. I'm sorry, you just have to wait until tomorrow. And I was like, what? Like, it's happening now. And you're saying I have to wait until tomorrow? And she's like, yes. And then we hung up. And that's when I like completely freaked out, right? Because yeah. I'm getting these alerts like, oh, and you've added so-and-so as a bill pay too. And I'm like, what? So I'm completely freaking out and I don't know what to do. I call my husband. I'm like, and he said, like, for the first time since we've been together, like, he was really scared. Like, he's like, you've never been like that ever. He's like, I thought your face fell off. And I was like, I don't know why that was his thought, but that's what he said. And he's just like, I didn't know what was going on. And I didn't understand what you were saying. And, but somehow in the brief, incoherent conversation I had with him, I started thinking, okay, there must be someone that I know that works at the bank. You know, this is a small town. I must know somebody that works at the bank. And if I don't know somebody who works at the bank, then I must know somebody who does, who can do something now. And so, so I got on the phone and started calling people and emailing people and texting people and being like, do you know anybody who works at Florence Bank that's a friend that we can contact right now, you know, like, just kept, and if you don't know any, can you ask your network of friends, you know, I really need to shut this fraud down now. And like, it was kind of like this big spider web that went out. And
yeah,
in about, I would say 15 minutes, my good friend Mike Corrado said, I do know somebody. And I was like, you do? And he's like, I'll get in touch with him right now. And then in another 20 minutes, his friend had called me and froze my account. And to, like I said, it has a happy ending. They did not, get any money whatsoever. So it was a really, really.
That's like a, I don't know. It's like almost like Ocean's Eleven. Maybe not quite that dramatic, but you know. But yeah, it's like in real time. And also it's like children's book people came through for you. So that's exciting.
It was children's book people that came through. Like, but I was asking everyone, you know, I was asking like the parents in my daughter's pod. I was like, I just was like, I have to cast a really, really wide net and figure it out. But what I really want to talk about in terms of this incident that I thought was so interesting afterwards, because it was such a relief, right? And and I felt so grateful, and I am still so grateful and thankful, like that this was such a big lesson for me that I got out of pretty much unscathed. So I'm really grateful for that. But the thing that I really took away from this is like, there was that moment before I called up all my friends and asked for help that I felt this huge, huge sense of shame, like so like this deep pit of shame. And I remember thinking maybe I could call friends to find out if somebody knows someone there. And when I had that thought, my first reaction was, no, I can't tell anybody. I can't tell anybody that I fell victim to this. I don't want people to know that I'm the kind of person who can get fished like this. Like, and it was really, really hard for me in that moment, like this internal struggle where I don't want to be the fool and I don't want to be seen as a fool. And it was the struggle letting that go. And like, I can't be so attached to my pride that I can't ask for help. And I can't be like so determined not to be seen as a fool that I can't face the reality that I did this, you know, like I can't pretend that I didn't just get fished, you know, like, and the reason why I think about that so much is because I, you know, extrapolate into the greater, our greater situation in the world and in our country. And I was like, oh, you know, this is what so many people are feeling. Like they don't want to be fools, right? And that's why so many of them believe in conspiracy theories. They think that everybody's trying to pull something over on them, you know? And it's that determination that nobody's going to take me for a fool. And then if deep down they kind of start feeling like, oh, wait, have I been taken for a fool? And like the unwillingness to face up to it, you know, it's such an interesting, interesting thing to think about. And I completely understand people who might be going through that because it was really, really painful. I physically felt nauseous and ill, you know, like trying to get a hold of myself and be like, it's okay.
It's okay to ask for help.
Ask for
help.
It's
okay to make mistakes.
It's okay to be human. It's okay to be the person that fell for this, you know,
like, right. And also, I mean, these people are criminals and they're smart and they, you know, they know how to trick people. Otherwise they wouldn't keep fishing, you know?
And okay. And I just, in my own defense, because I do feel very self-conscious about being, being taken for a fool, but in my own defense, they are really, really good because the next day I went to the bank and I got whole new accounts, like it's in person. So I know I'm not getting fooled, you know, and it's all like at the bank. And the person that's helping me, he's like, okay, I'm going to call tech so we can set up your whole new password and username. And he calls up, he's like, okay. And then he says, okay, they gave you a new temporary password. The new temporary password is red123. And I said, what? Like, the new temporary password is red123. That's like, it was so, in some ways it was kind of funny because the lame password that the fisher gave me was the thing that made me feel like something was off. And then I realized like, that's actually really close to what they do. You know, like that's what they do in real life. That's probably why he chose that because that's what they really do in real life. They pick a really lame password, temporary password.
I mean, that made me think that maybe it was an inside job, you know, someone who had worked for the bank maybe and knew kind of the pattern of passwords that they picked.
Yeah. Or because it just shows how good they are. So like, when I think about that, that kind of makes me feel like a little bit better. I still feel like I should have known better. I should have known better, but at the same time, I try to not be so harsh on myself, you know?
And I think it's important to talk about because I do think that if you talk about it, then people are a little bit more aware of the types of scams, you know, that people are doing. I mean, I do feel like, I don't know. I do think it was an inside job because it was also the day after you had talked to the bank too. I mean, that, you know, that just everything they did, I think was smart in a way to make sure your guard was down and that you were trusting.
Yeah.
Who you're talking to. So
in general, I think as a rule of thumb from now on, I'm never going to give and what makes it weird is I never gave my password, which probably would have really tipped me off. But it was enough information because when you don't remember your password, they say, okay, you know, give me. So anyway, it was enough information that they could.
Right. Well, I mean that, I think this was already our first topic of this Chop Suey episode, but that segues to, I guess, our official first topic is also about phishing. So some of you listeners might have read the very strange and interesting New York Times article on this topic, and we'll link to it in our show notes. But the headline is, "Why on Earth is Someone Stealing Unpublished Book Manuscripts?" So to summarize this story, someone has been impersonating editors and agents and emailing authors using publishing speak and asking for their manuscript drafts. The article says that the emails are tailored, so they appear to be sent by a particular agent writing to one of her authors or an editor contacting a scout with tiny changes made to the domain names, like instead of Penguin Random House, it'll be Penguin Randorn House, where instead of an M, it's an RN. So it's kind of masked, and you know, only if you're really looking carefully would you notice that. So apparently this kind of phishing scam has been happening for over 3 years. At Hachette Book Group, we've received several warnings from our IT department to be aware of this and to let authors know. So it's really perplexing. And I think the most kind of perplexing part of it is that no one knows what the end game is. Like the manuscripts aren't ending up on the dark web, or as far as people can tell, they're not really ending up as, like, say, self-published manuscripts or anything like that. So yeah, it's very strange. And I, you know, it makes me a little bit paranoid, but I don't know, Grace, what do you think of this?
Well, it's so weird because I've been trying to think about what the end game is. Like, why is somebody stealing like manuscript drafts, you know? Like, it's such a weird thing. I guess maybe they're just trying to get ideas. Like, I was reading someplace that they're like, maybe they're just trying to get ideas of what's in the zeitgeist, kind of like, and so they can make TV shows but not have to pay authors. Like, somebody was saying how there's like a TV show now that's basically just like MT Anderson's feed, but it's not feed, so they don't have to pay him anything. So I'm like, maybe it's something like that. It's like they can read the books.
I mean, it could be something like that, but feed has been out for many, like a long time. So it's, you know, it's, yeah, it is really interesting. I mean, and I think what's interesting is that it's not just the big names. It's just, it's, you know, I think the article led with, I think it was like a debut author, and it wasn't like a huge auction or anything like that. It's interesting. But I think it's very easy. Like, I feel like, so if you got an email that you thought it was from me and I said, "Hey, Grace, can you send me the most recent draft of your manuscript?" Like, would you just reply it?
I would just reply and attach it. Yeah. Which is so, so weird that, that they like, to me, I'm like, why would anybody else want this? You know, because it's so bad for the first draft. But yeah, I just think it's just so interesting. Like, to me, of course, my mind goes to like, oh, what an interesting book this could make. You know, like it's like the stealer of stories. Like somebody's trying to steal all the stories, you know, like
someone's going to be listening to this podcast and stealing ideas.
So of course I came up with this whole like fantasy idea of like the stealer of stories, like maybe it's a book coming true. maybe it's somebody doing research, just wants to know how easy it would be to write something like the stealer of stories, and the stories that she steals or he or she steals, like, oh, it really worked. I'll do it from real life.
I think it makes me, because the perpetrators kind of understand publishing speak, that makes me feel like, again, you know, we're talking about inside jobs, like I feel like it's someone who used to work in publishing or maybe even currently works in publishing. And I don't know what the end game is, but Yeah, I just, you know, it's interesting also, this is completely unrelated, but, you know, in today's day and age with how technology works, you know, we have a summer intern program. And I remember one summer, you know, if you're smart enough to use the systems and you know all of the, you know, the files and where things are kept and early reading, you know, copies and drafts and stuff, you can kind of, you know, you can track down a book that you want to read. And we had an intern, and I don't even know in which department, but who was a huge fan of a certain author and had gone on to some of our systems and downloaded the manuscript and, you know, didn't really understand, like wasn't doing anything with it necessarily, like wasn't, you know, posting it anywhere, but not really realizing that that was kind of a no-no to do, you know? And I think in, with all, I don't know, I feel like this new generation, you know, they're so used to getting a lot of things for free, like, you know, downloading things for free that, you know, I just hope that people understand in the intellectual property and copyright and, yeah, and that authors need to get paid for their yes. work. And, yeah.
Yes, we do. We really do need to get paid.
Yes. Okay, so we thought we would talk about some publishing news because at the beginning of this year, there actually was quite a few things happening. One piece of news is that Christian Trimmer is moving to MTV Books. So Christian Trimmer was the publisher over at Henry Holt, which is part of Macmillan. And he is moving over to kind of relaunch MTV Books, which was an imprint that you know, used to exist, and then kind of was just not, you know, nothing was happening with it.
What kind of books do they publish? Entertainment books?
I think so. I mean, I think it's kind of like, so some of their biggest hits, well, actually, so they published Perks of Being a Wallflower, they by Stephen Chbosky. They published Soul Surfer by Bethany Hamilton, Tupac Shakur. So I think a lot of them are related to entertainment, you know, maybe screenwriters and that kind of thing. So I'm not actually sure, you know, what the new vision of MTV Books will be. It will be housed under SNS, Simon & Schuster, under the branded publishing group there. So I think it'll be interesting. And especially, you know, I think last week or maybe the week before, or last week with Jennifer Loughran, we were talking about imprints closing. And so I think it's kind of nice to hear that there are kind of new imprints starting as well to kind of balance that out.
That's true. They probably won't do too much children's though, will they?
Probably more YA is my understanding. And then Emily Meehan, the other piece of publishing news. So she was publisher at Disney Publishing. And it was just announced that she is now going to be the new head of Barnes & Noble's Sterling Books. So Sterling has existed for quite a while. But I think the thought is that she is going to kind of relaunch, you know, or just, you know, maybe have Sterling go in a new direction. I think some of you might know that Barnes & Noble was bought last year and under new ownership of James Daunt, and he's been making a lot of changes to Barnes & Noble. So I guess, you know, along the same lines, they're going to make changes to Sterling. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there as well. And then the last piece of news this past week that was announced is Inkyard Press is launching a middle grade publishing program. So Inkyard was actually the YA imprint of Harlequin Books. They kind of rebranded smartly as Inkyard because I think Harlequin has quite a brand name recognition already for, you know, romance mainly. And of course the YA, you know, division of Harlequin was not publishing only romance. They did a lot of fantasy and sci-fi. And so they rebranded as Inkyard and they just announced that they're launching a middle grade publishing program.
Oh, that's cool. That means so.
Yeah, so just more places, I think, to be published.
But what kind of struck me, which I thought was interesting, is like all these heads are moving, right? Mm-hmm. And I was also curious.
That's quite a vision.
So I'm curious about like how much does changing the top affect mm-hmm. everything else? Like, how much does it trickle down all the way to the books? Like, I guess I think about this mainly because of our, you know, our country state, right? And, you know, when you change presidents before Trump was president, I just, it I always kind of felt like it didn't really affect me too much. Like I involved myself, but I didn't think it affected me, you know? But having him as president, I realized how much it really affected everything, actually, like the discourse, the way, you know, every day, like the unrest and the instability, like, and it just really shows how, to me, like how the people on top really affect everything. And do you think it's the same with publishing?
I think what's true is that the person at the top can change a lot. I think that usually when you're changing the person at the top and the company or the division or the imprint has been successful, they're usually trying to find someone who will kind of keep the same vision and kind of company culture. So like, for example, you know, since I've been at Little Brown, you know, when I first started, John Keller was the publisher, and then he retired about 2 years after I started. And then we have David Ford as our publisher. And there wasn't too much of a cultural change, I think, from John to David, like they kind of, you know, kind of kept the status quo. And of course, there are some changes. And of course, I think it mainly affects the people who report to the top. Because I think who your boss is makes a huge difference, or can make a huge difference in terms of your job satisfaction and your kind of your day to day, you know. And then Megan Tingley, who's currently our publisher, you know, she became publisher, gosh, I don't know how many years ago now, at least 10, probably 15 years ago, you know, and so she's been really stable for us. So I think, though, that it can make a big difference. And if they are trying to kind of like, we're trying to rebrand or relaunch or, you know, kind of change the picture, you know, if maybe a division hasn't been doing well and they want to do better, then I think the person at the top can make really major changes. You know, they can decide that they want to bring their own people in. They might lay some people off. They might change the vision of the publishing. You know, they might say, look, we don't want to be publishing a ton of like YA fantasy anymore. We want to do more picture books, you know? So I do feel like the person at the top can make a lot of changes, but I think it depends on the situation.
So you don't feel like I guess I was wondering, like, do you feel it like in subtle ways, just when people change, like all of a sudden, like the change from John to David, like all of a sudden you kind of felt like the books should be, I don't know, more commercial, you know, or something like that. There wasn't any subtle things like that.
For me, I was so low on the publishing hierarchy that it didn't really make a huge difference. But I, you know, I think in terms of, say, publishers changing, for me, what makes a big difference is if the publisher has come through the editorial side versus the sales side or marketing side, you know, because the person at the top could have come through any of those, you know, departments. So for me, I love it when the publisher is also an editor, as Megan is and was, you know, because she really understands, you know, very implicitly, you know, what we're going through and what we have to deal with. So I do feel like, you know, there's a little bit more understanding, I think, of what editors go through. So there's definitely there are definitely differences for sure. And now here is our What We Should Be Reading segment. Joining us is special guest Allison Morris, Senior Director of Title Selection at First Book. Once a month during our Chop Suey episodes, Allison Morris will be telling us what we should be reading.
Welcome, Allison.
Hi, thank you. Always great to be with you guys.
So excited to hear what we should be reading.
Yeah. So it's funny. I was thinking about should is always such a tricky word. Like, I mean, what you should be reading is what you want to, but I can encourage you in particular directions. So we'll put it that way.
Okay.
So I thought as we kick off this new segment that I would focus on books that are coming out right now for this month, partly because I am seeing so much good stuff in 2021 that it's bringing me a lot of hope. And I thought I could maybe pay some of that hope forward by featuring a few titles that I know are coming out this month that I am particularly excited about. So I'm gonna mention several and I'm gonna do them in very short fashion. And people should feel free to give their feedback on how they feel about this method style of book talking. So first I'll just start youngest and do picture books. And there's two titles that feel especially relevant and needed to me in the fictional picture book category. One of which is Lei Wen Pham's new picture book, Outside Inside. And this is a book that is literally a book about the quarantine. It is about what we've all been going through right now, what we are continuing to go through right now. And I think for a lot of kids, it'll be meaningful to, even at this moment, step back and sort of reflect on what it has been like to be at home and to see that represented on the pages of a book that has just beautiful illustrations. So that is Outside Inside by Lei Wen, spelled L-E-U-Y-E-N, Pham, P-H-A-M. And also relevant, I think, is a title called Puppy in My Head, which is a book about mindfulness by Elise Gravel, G-R-A-V-E-L. I don't know about you guys. I feel like I have a puppy in my head right now a lot. And that puppy is super active. And this is a book about, you know, being kind to that puppy and maybe taking some time to let it calm down a bit. And it's kind of a nice way of stepping outside of ourselves. We think of our brains as being like puppies. I don't know about you guys, but I just want to pet mine when I hear
that's such a great image.
Yeah. And so it's a book that I think actually, I mean, it skews quite young. The text is very simple and you can use it as young as preschool, but I think even adults can benefit from reading Puppy in My Head.
And I love Elise Gravel's work. She did these Olga books. She's done lots of things that we really love. So
yeah, they have just a really playful simplicity. I think her books, and I don't know, I'm particularly taken with. So those are two fiction picture books. There's a lot of really great nonfiction coming out this month. Peter Cease has a gorgeous new picture book called Nikki and Vera, A Quiet Hero of the Holocaust and the Children He Rescued. And the subtitle pretty much tells you what the book is going to be about. Of course, what it can't prepare you for is just the level of intricacy and beauty and detail in Peter Cease's work. But it is about a man named Nicholas Winton, who, when he was 29 years old, he saved the lives of almost 700 children who were trapped in Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. And there is a really compelling video you can watch of him in the 1980s actually meeting some of the grown-ups who were the children that he helped rescue decades before. He had not followed their stories and did not know what had happened to any of them. And so it is incredibly moving to watch this episode in which he's surprised by them being in the audience.
I think I remember seeing that video. And I think if I remember correctly, like, he never even told anybody that he had done that.
Right. And that's part of what's so compelling about this story is, like, this was definitely not a man who was doing this for any sort of outside recognition or accolades. Like, he did it because it was the right thing to do and because he had really a limited window of time and opportunity. And he took as much advantage of that as he could to save the lives of other people. It's a beautiful book, and the story behind it is moving, and having that additional content to share with readers, I think, is really meaningful as well. And so that is, again, called Nikki and Vera, and that's by Peter Cease, S-I-S. Alicia D. Williams, who won a Newbery Honor for her middle grade novel, Genesis Begins Again, has a really vibrant, entertaining picture book biography of Zora Neale Hurston called Jump at the Sun, true life tale of unstoppable story catcher Zora Neale Hurston. And it incorporates both the language and the flavor and really that kind of energy, joyful energy of Zora Neale Hurston's writing and storytelling. And I just was bowled over by it. I loved the art. I love the writing. My notes said Caldecott contender, Newbery contender, because I just felt like it really captured the sense of Zora Neale Hurston and who she was and what her storytelling was like. So that's Jump at the Sun by Alicia D. Williams. And that is illustrated by Jacqueline Alcantara, whose name I hope I'm not butchering. Apologies to Jacqueline if I am. And then particularly relevant to me this week is the book, The Highest Tribute, Thurgood Marshall's Life, Leadership, and Legacy. This is a new nonfiction picture book by Kekla Magoon, illustrated by Laura Freeman. And the reason I'm really thinking about it this week in particular is because Kamala Harris is being sworn in by Justice Sonia Sotomayor using Thurgood Marshall's Bible. And so I love that this has a particular connection we can make back to kids to understand the depth and the meaning of the work that Thurgood Marshall did and how much he accomplished and how there's a through line to events that are happening right now. So those are sort of my picture book and nonfiction recs. And then middle grade wise, Katie and the Cat Sitter is one of the funniest graphic novels I've read in a long time. It's by Colleen A.F. Venable and Stephanie Yu. And it is about a girl who gets a cat sitting job for a woman in her building who's very mysterious, this beautiful African-American woman who seems to have a secret thing she does every night. And she hires Katie to be the cat sitter for her 217 cats, each of whom has a really unusual skill or ability. And it is just, it's a gem. It's really a really entertaining story. And Katie lives in a world that is populated with superheroes and villains. And that plays a big role in the story as well.
I remember you talking about that book in our Christmas episode or a holiday episode. So I've been really looking for that one now.
True. And I'm forgetting that I did talk about it then. So now everyone knows it is a book that I won't shut up about because it's
and it's out now.
It is out now. Yeah, it just came out last week.
Back then it wasn't out. So now they know to get it.
Now it is out.
We bid on that at auction and lost it. So I also am a fan of it. That is all right.
Yes, I am sorry to hear that. It is being edited by the lovely Shana Corey at Random House. The series is. And I'm really excited to see where else it goes. It's just great. It's great. I am reading right now Amari and the Knight Brothers by debut author B.B. Alston. And this is the story of an African-American girl named Amari whose brother has gone missing. It's been about 6 months. She is very upset about this, but it turns out her brother was an agent for a very secret agency that exists in a supernatural world that you and I cannot see with a regular eye. And it's really engaging, lots of action and adventure. And it's basically Harry Potter meets Men in Black. And I've been hearing lots of people describe it that way. I'm like, oh yeah, that feels apt. So yes. I'm reading that right now, nearing the finish line and really excited about that book.
That's another one we lost at auction.
Oh, wow, Vina. Wow, I am just hitting them left.
No, it's great though.
But it's just good stuff coming. And I just finished on audio listening to a middle grade novel by Christine Day called The Sea in Winter. And this is a really beautiful, very thoughtful novel. Quiet but engaging about a girl who has really loved taking ballet and in fact going to a ballet specific school, but now has an injury that's preventing her from doing that. And it's a contemporary Native American story. The main character is Macaw Piscataway, is her tribal nation affiliation. And I love the moments in the book where we learn more about her mother's heritage, Native American heritage, and the Native American heritage of both her biological father and her stepfather in the story. So it was just a book that to me was had a lot of really quiet surprises, and I found it really satisfying.
That's great. Well, would you like to stick around? Because we thought for our next segment that we would take a stab at making our Caldecott and Newbery predictions.
Sure. Yes,
it would be so much fun to hear what you have in mind.
So, and okay. I think I might have mentioned earlier that we are recording this on Monday, January 18th, but by the time this episode airs, the announcements will have already happened. So you'll know just how wrong or maybe right we were. But we just thought we would go ahead and, you know, again, we're neglecting YA. I don't have any Prince predictions, but we thought we'd focus on Caldecott and Newbery. Okay, so why don't I start? Because actually last week at Little Brown, we did our annual mock Caldecott. And so I might've mentioned this last year, but what we do is we kind of come up with a short list of the books that we feel like will be contenders, mainly based on reviews and what's being talked about on those, you know, mock Caldecott and Newbery blogs, or specifically Caldecott blogs. And then we each pick one or two books to kind of delve into a little bit more deeply. And then we take turns kind of talking about the book, you know, our response to it, and if we think it might have a chance, you know, comparing it to the criteria. So in this case, I'm going to share what our in-house picks were. So our editorial director of Picture Books, Andrea Spooner, she asked us all afterwards to let her know which we felt was most likely to get a sticker and which we most wished would get a sticker.
And oh, I like so, that.
Yeah. And so the most likely to get a sticker, the winner was We Are Water Protectors by Carol Lindstrom, illustrated by Michaela Goad. And then the second most voted for, which would technically, I guess, receive an honor, was The Old Truck by the Pumphrey Brothers. But then when you look at what we most wished would get a sticker, again, We Are Water Protectors came in first. And then second place was If You Come to Earth by Sophie Blackall. And I feel like, I will say that maybe we're a little bit biased at Little Brown because we have published Michaela Goad in the past, and we've also published Sophie Blackall. Yeah. So, you know, that kind of makes sense. But actually what I voted for in terms of what I thought would get a sticker, I also thought We Are Water Protectors, but I also thought Honeybee by Candace Fleming, illustrated by Eric Roman, was a likely medal winner. And then my personal wish, and this won't be a surprise because this was our pick for the original art show as well, was Moon Bear by Matthew Burgess, illustrated by Katia Chen.
Yeah,
so those were my Caldecott picks. Allison, what are your Caldecott predictions?
First of all, let me just say that I always struggle with doing this because I'm like, but there's so many things I love.
I know, that's very true.
And I do often feel like, oh, there's a difference between like what everyone is expecting to win and what I personally love. And so there are books that I loved from this year that I think won't get the Caldecott, but I love them more, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's just because the award does one specific thing and recognizes one specific thing. But the ones that you've mentioned are absolutely on my list in terms of what I think is likely to win. And also ones that I actually really quite like as well. I agree. I think that I think We Are Water Protectors is really likely to get at least an honor, if not the medal. The Old Truck has been just beloved from the day it came out. It's one of those books that I think is so simple that people sometimes overlook it for that reason. But I don't know. Librarians have been really over the moon about it since it first debuted. So that certainly bodes well. I love The Bear in the Moon, the one that you mentioned as your personal favorite.
Right. My shortcut was Moon Bear, but that is not the title. or is it the title?
It's The Bear in the Moon.
Okay.
I just verified it because I was like, oh, maybe I have it wrong. I think it's beautiful. I love Katia Chen's work. And I think it's also a book that's just really sophisticated, but works for a very young audience, which is always an interesting combination to me. So I loved it. I'm also always interested in what nonfiction can win the Caldecott. And a couple of my favorite illustrated nonfiction books, The Oldest Student, How Mary Walker Learned to Read, illustrated by Oge Mora. I love everything Oge does. And that book has just really stayed with me this year. And I think about it all the time. And then Frank Morrison's illustrations for Above the Rim, How Elgin Baylor Changed Basketball by Jen Bryant, I also think are pretty extraordinary. I'd be really curious to hear how the committee regards that work in that book, but I think Frank Morrison's paintings are extraordinary. So yeah, so those are my thoughts right now, overlapping a great deal with yours, but also based on what I think is more likely to win.
Grace, how about you?
So I have to admit that I have not kept up very well with this year's books, either the Caldecott or the Newbery contenders. I've just been kind of like popping in and out and seeing what's around. But a book that I just thought was absolutely beautiful is All Because You Matter by Brian Collier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just think when I saw that like kind of took my breath away, and I kind of felt like this has got to win something. I think it was just so beautiful, and his work is so amazing, and he's never won the gold medal, so I kind of feel like, you know, it's a good time for him to break that ceiling for him personally. I think
Yeah. And I think we should say that book was written by Tammy Charles.
Oh, yes. Sorry, Tammy. But so I'm kind of hoping for that one, though I do love all the other books that have been mentioned. But that's kind of my wish as well as
yes. So I think,
and you're not alone. It's on a lot. I've been seeing it pop up recently on a lot of prediction lists. It's actually one that I confess I need to go back and revisit because I haven't looked at it in a while. But I do. Yeah. I love Brian Collier's work.
I do too. I've worked with Brian quite a bit, and he's just a joy. So I do think he deserves the gold. I would prefer it for a book that we work on together, but that's okay. he deserves it. All right, so let's move on to Newbery. And actually, I will say, you know, I also have not kept up on Middle Grade that came out in 2020, to be honest. And I've mentioned this one graphic novel before, because I think it's one of the few probably eligible, you know, books that I read last year for the Newbery, but I love it. So I do think it has a chance, and that's When Stars Are Scattered by Omar Mohammed and Victoria Jameson. And I read that actually because Allison had recommended it on one of her 2-minute book reviews.
It's also one I won't shut up about. So
yeah, it's so wonderful. And then my other guess, and I haven't read this book, but I have read other work by Kaysen Callender, is King and the Dragonflies. And I think, you know, that won the National Book Award. I think it also won the Boston Globe Horn Book Award. So I do think that probably is a strong contender for the Newbery. Allison, what do you think?
I have those three on my predictions list as well. I think Kaysen Callender's writing is beautiful in King and the Dragonflies. When Stars Are Scattered is a book that I mean, truly, like, I've been talking about nonstop since I read it early last spring. I was texting people who I thought might have already read it because I so badly wanted to talk to other people about it. Because it's just a book that is so moving and I think evokes so much empathy. And I think the writing is incredibly strong. So yes, that is high on my list and maybe number one on my list of potential awardees. I am wild about Skunk and Badger, written by Amy Timberlake, illustrated by John Klassen. It is hilarious. Gareth and I have read it aloud twice as a read aloud, and it is honestly, I was in my kitchen and reading it aloud to no one because it wanted to be read aloud so badly, and it was so much fun. The language is beautiful and funny, and it's just, I don't know, I just think I love seeing a sort of chapter book length book that has such compelling writing, and I think that the committee would be hard pressed to find a lot to. Yeah, I think people will vote for that one. I also really can't stop thinking about Fighting Words by Kimberly Brubaker Bradley. And so that is on my list. It would be a surprising choice for the Newbery Committee, but that would excite me as well. It's an incredibly powerful story, and the writing it's just this character's voice comes right off the page and she doesn't leave you. And then the other book that I just keep thinking about is From the Desk of Zoe Washington by Janae Marks. It is not one where the writing is the thing that jumps out at you, but the structure of the novel, the storytelling, there's so many things that I think make it a really tight-knit novel in a way that's really satisfying. And I could see the Newbery Committee potentially giving a nod to that one as well.
Cool. Wonderful. Grace, how about you?
Like I said, I haven't really read that much this year, but I'm going with Prairie Lotus by Linda Sue Park, mainly because I just think it's so incredibly gutsy what she's doing with this book. You know, basically, you know, there's been all this controversy for years about Little House on the Prairie. In fact, I mean, that's what I did my PBS NewsHour thing about I don't even know how many years ago, but that's when the one I got so much like violent trolls and spamming about because I had dared to call Little House on the Prairie racist, right? And here she is trying to address that, like, and show another story of during that time. And I just think it's such a great way to kind of illuminate kids who are reading Little House on the Prairie. Like, there's more than this story of Laura Ingalls Wilder. There's these other stories that we haven't heard that really exist out there. And I think it's just such a wonderful thing that she's doing.
I think you're totally right, Grace. Now I'm like, oh, why didn't I have that on my list too? I'm excited. Now I have my fingers crossed for that one as well. I have too many favorites, you guys.
Yeah.
I think all your points are great. And it's just a really well-written book.
Yeah, it's just such a, in some ways it's kind of fun because, well, it's it's really fun for me not having a book eligible or anything like that. So yeah. I'm like, yay, I can be happy no matter what. So it's really
yes,
fun.
We can just celebrate all the great books.
I will also just say, just again, tossing two nonfiction loves in the mix, all 13, you guys heard me talk about at the holidays, mm-hmm. The Incredible Cave Rescue of the Thai Boys Soccer Team by Christina Sundtornvat. I can't stop thinking about it. And it's another one that I'm telling everyone to read. It's just so good that I would love to see that get recognition. And it's possible that that could even get Newbery recognition. It's unusual for a nonfiction book of its sort to be in that, on that final list, but I would be thrilled to see that. And I also think it's got Seibert potential. And then the other nonfiction book that I was bowled over by is A Sporting Chance, How Ludwig Guttmann Created the Paralympic Games, written by Laurie Alexander and illustrated by Alan Drummond. I thought I would find this book kind of interesting. And I sort of flipped to a page in the middle and read it and thought, well, that was fascinating. And then I went back to the beginning and then I could not stop reading it. And I learned a ton. And it's just super engaging. The topic is fascinating. And basically Ludwig Guttmann was the guy who believed that people who had, who were quadriplegic, paraplegic, who'd had any sort of mobility issues, spinal injuries, he was the one person who really believed that there was a potential life for them beyond just staying in bed, and found all of these incredible ways to remedy issues that they were having physically that were what was really threatening their lives, and then figuring out how to give their lives back to them through sports. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
So we'll see. Fingers crossed. Yes,
our listeners will find out before we do.
I know.
and we'll see how right or wrong we were.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Allison, for joining us.
Yeah. Thanks for having Allison. Me. It's always a treat.
Okay. For our next segment, I thought I would do a little bit of story sharing. So we can call this story sharing with Grace, because during the whole fishing incident that I talked about at the top of this episode, the whole thing reminded me of a Buddhist story that has I've always remembered. And this story particularly came back to me after the incident. So the story is called Heaven and Hell. And it's a story about how there was once this samurai, a very admired and brave and respected samurai, who heard about this monk who was supposed to be wise, the wisest man of all of Japan. So the very famous and respected and brave samurai went to the monk and said to him, "Tell me what you know of heaven and hell." And the monk looked at the samurai and said, "You are stupid, samurai. Why would I tell you anything?" And the samurai was so angry. And he said, "How dare you say that to me?" And he whipped out his sword, was about to slash the monk. The monk said to him, "That is what hell feels like." Mm-hmm. With those words, the samurai stopped in mid-slash and thought about it and suddenly understood. And he put his sword back into his scabbard. I don't know if they have scabbards in Japanese samurais, but he put it back in. And he slowly calmed down and felt this great relief and great understanding come over him. And the monk looked at him and said, "That is what heaven feels like." And I just love that story so much. And it reminds me so much of what I went through, because when I was so upset during the fishing incident, like where my husband couldn't really understand anything I was saying, and I was like, I had kind of hit this like abyss of negative emotion, you know. And then when it was over and I realized it was safe and everything was fine, and the fisher wasn't able to get anything, like such the relief, you know, like such a wonderful relief. So like so much happiness. Like I joked to Mike Carotta, I'm like, I think I'm happier now than when I won the Caldecott honor.
Like, oh, wow.
It's like, cause it was such an extreme, you know, and it was such a relief, like, because I had imagined such a horrible vision before. I was like, everything's gone, the money's gone, we're like the house, I can't make mortgage payment, I can't, like everything's gone, and we're destitute because everything's, all the money has been drained out, you know, like that horrible vision that I had made for myself in like 5 seconds, you know, versus like, oh, that vision will never happen now. And like, wow, this is heaven, you know? So I think about that a lot. And I think that it really does kind of really explain what heaven and hell is. But it also kind of explains how heaven and hell can be so much of your own mind. So
yeah, it is kind of like how you look at things, right? That's like, I guess it comes down to that, but it's also experience. Yeah. So we've talked about how it's hard to be truly happy if you've never been truly sad, you know? So I guess yes. Having the juxtaposition of all different positive and negative emotions, I guess.
Yeah. And I wonder, I wonder if that hellish feeling for me, that hellish feeling was that feeling of suffering without power, you know, like the ultimate, like, no, like, because I was fine until the woman told me there's nothing you can do, you know? And then when I heard that, like, that was such a horrible feeling, you know, like I have to suffer and I have no power. And then when everything was okay, the idea of like, oh, the relief, the joy, and like not needing to have power almost, you know? So.
But also maybe realizing that you did have power all along, right? Yeah. Because you were able to
change
to
things.
Sort it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's an interesting thing.
Things to ponder. Thank you for that story. And now we'll end, as we always do, with what we're grateful for. And now we'll end, as we always do, with what we're grateful for. So I'll start this week. I'm sure I've said I'm grateful for Stephen before, but now that we're trying to establish our life back in Brooklyn together, and I mentioned feeling like we're kind of in limbo and still transitioning a bit, but I've been really grateful for kind of his good nature and his willingness to help and adapt. And, you know, like, he had never met Erica before, for example, you know, but he, you know, was able to, you know, to open up to her. And, you know, we had a nice little life here for 2 weeks, you know, the three of us, and cooking dinner together and getting to know each other. And, you know, and he's been such a trooper when I come, you know, he would drive the car, and we had to take like several trips into Manhattan to her apartment there, and then bring them back here. And then her stuff is here, you know, is sitting in our kitchen for like a week, and then just bring it, you know, finally brought it over to her place. And, you know, so it's just been a lot of kind of chaos, but through it all, he's just been really great about it. So I am grateful for Stephen.
Yay.
Grace, what are you grateful for?
Well, I guess I'm grateful for many things. I mean, I told my parents about what had happened with the fishing thing. And what was interesting was my mom said, that's the first good thing of this year. And I thought that was such an interesting take on it, right? She's like, it's the first good thing. And I was like, you know, you're right. Because it's the first good thing, because it turned out fine, you know, it turned out okay. So I am very grateful that it turned out okay. I'm really grateful for all my friends that helps. I'm really grateful that Mike Corrado was willing to help, and he knew somebody who worked there. I'm really grateful to his friend. But, you know, I also, you know, you're talking with Stephen, and I was like, I'm really grateful to my husband, Alex, too, because, you know, when I called him up to tell him what had happened, and I was like really incoherent, I think there was a part of me that was waiting for him to say the things that I was saying to myself, like, you're so stupid, you're so dumb, how could you have fallen for that? He didn't make me feel worse about it. And I think that with him giving me that support is what kind of helped me decide to reach out for help. So I'm really grateful for him for like helping me steer in the correct direction that gave me the good outcome that I did. So that is what I'm grateful for.
Hooray for great partners.
Yes, hooray for good luck.
Yes. And that was our inaugural Chop Suey episode. Thanks for joining us. And thanks to Hachette Audio, Little Brown Books for Young Readers, and Alex at Pacey Work Studio for producing and editing this podcast. You can find me at Planet Alvina on Twitter and at Alvina Ling on Instagram.
And I'm at Pacey Lynn on both platforms. We love hearing feedback, so keep tagging and messaging us on social media using the hashtag BookFriendsForever, or send us a message via our website, bookfriendsforever.com. You can also see more detailed show notes there.
And if you have any suggestions for future topics to cover, please let us know. And of course, please remember to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. And if you like this podcast, please tell a friend about it.
And please, please join our Patreon. We would so appreciate it, and it would really help us continue doing this podcast. The link is in the show notes.
I'm Alvina Ling.
And I'm Grace Lynn.
Have a great week.
And don't forget to read. Bye.